division will come to order. First bill we have up on our agenda today is Senate File 3094, Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, if I might have a minute talking with the stakeholders for a minute on this bill about the fiscal note. Haven't had a time to talk.
Yeah,
with.
Well, as long as you're doing that, Senator Dahl, one of the questions I was going to have is whether the Department of Commerce actuary is the same actuary that the Department of Health has in their fiscal note.
Okay.
Or if we need two actuaries from two different departments on your bill.
I will ask that question, if I may have just a couple of minutes. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Thank you.
Is Senator Anderson here?
It seems, but it's not.
The asthma coverage bill.
The what?
Asthma.
Oh, yeah.
This one. Can I have a copy?
I'm hoping that Brian has them and that he's copied them for the.
Oh, maybe he has. I didn't know.
Okay. It's not. He will go make copies.
Senator Anderson.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Sorry, I'm just trying to catch up here. I just received this delete all amendment, and I really appreciate Ms. Cavanaugh has been working hard to accommodate our efforts at amending the bill. Let me just turn my phone off. Sorry, Madam Chair. It's kind of a crazy morning. So this bill relates to indoor ice arenas and air quality in the arenas. And it's been a work in progress for many, many weeks. And what we are trying to do is protect the health of skaters in indoor arenas. And we know that with resurfacing equipment, Zambonis and other equipment like similar equipment, most of them are propane-fueled or another kind of fossil fuel that creates air emissions in a concentrated space that can be dangerous to your health, carbon monoxide and nitrogen dioxide. The ice arenas are obviously very aware of this, and there's been a law in place for many years in Minnesota to set up a structure for testing those emissions. And the health department is in the process of doing a rulemaking to try to modernize and update the standards. We introduced the bill because we wanted to make sure that we were doing everything that we could to protect the health of our kids and adults who are skating and coaching and participating in those sports on ice arenas. And we know that there's been episodes of hockey teams going being hospitalized or getting sick. So we know there's still a problem in some cases. What we originally proposed in the bill was that every arena would have to have a carbon monoxide monitoring system, a real-time monitoring system that would continuously monitor the emissions above the ice and have an alarm that would go off if it exceeded standards, air quality standards, and be connected into the ventilation system so that the fans would turn on. And every arena has that type of a ventilation system already by law. We also wanted to set more stringent air quality standards based on health information that we've researched, and we had testimony in the policy committee from a doctor who's an expert with the World Health Organization. But the concern, of course, that we've run into is that ice arenas, which are mostly run by local government, and this Department of Health obviously are both under, or all under, very tight fiscal constraints. So what we've been trying to do is respond to the concerns that have been raised by a number of stakeholders, and we've had a number of iterations of this bill, and trying to take away the fiscal impact on the state budget in particular, because the health department, we've been talking to them about, and they've been giving us new fiscal notes that suggest they need a lot more staff to do what we had proposed. So,
Senator Anderson, do you have a fiscal note for the amendment?
No. We don't at this point.
All right. Well, then why don't we take some testimony on the amendment, and then we'll lay the bill over because we need a fiscal note before we can act.
And, Madam Chair, I don't know if the health department could give us some guidance. We have a fiscal note on the House Delete All Amendment, which is not the same as this, but it's moving in some of the same direction. And the health department gave us some quick guidance yesterday about what they thought that the fiscal note would be. So hopefully they could prepare something pretty quickly. But we keep making changes to try to reduce the fiscal impact. So if I can explain what we are proposing at this point in the amendment, have some brief testimony, and then I'm hoping that we can still have an opportunity to move something forward this session.
Oh, yes, we can reschedule the bill for you. We just need to have a fiscal note. There's no point in having this committee hear it if we don't have one.
I understand. And it has been a work in progress, so we're trying to get there. So what we've done is listen to a lot of people, and here's what I'm proposing in the A10 amendment. And I'll just go through it section by section. First, in Subdivision 1, we want to ensure that every arena has someone who is trained in the maintenance and operation of the resurfacing equipment and the ventilation system and in health quality standards. Now, many arenas already have this, but we want to put that into law to make sure that every arena has someone who is adequately trained to do that. One of the things that we've learned through the process of all this discussion is that if you have properly tuned and maintained equipment, you may not run afoul of health standards. And so we're hoping that this will make sure that in the future the equipment is properly maintained and just is in good working order so that it's at its prime level of operation in terms of emissions. We set it up in this section so that either you'd have to have someone on site who is in charge of this maintenance of the equipment, or you'd have to have someone who's available on call, because in some of the larger systems, Ramsey County, for example, they run a number of arenas, and they have a maintenance and mechanical staff that services 11 different arenas. And so we didn't want to require that they had to have someone on staff at all times in the arena, but we want to make sure that there's access to that person. And then we also say on 116 to 117 that each arena has to make their air quality measurements available to the public upon request, because that's something that's come up a lot, that people want to know how their arena is doing. And they already, under current law and current rules, have to do a weekly test of the air quality and send that to the health department quarterly. So that's the information we're asking to be made available to the public on request. Second, subdivision two relates to the equipment restrictions. And so what we're requiring here is that by next year, every arena would have to install a catalytic converter on their resurfacing equipment. And that is a very significant way to reduce harmful emissions by doing that, and one of the least expensive things that can be done to reduce emissions. And a number of arenas have done that. And that should be a lot less expensive than installing monitoring equipment. Second, by 2013, we have a requirement in place on 122 that just relates to using other kinds of emissions-creating equipment and says you can't do that less than 2 hours before skaters are on the ice. Third, by 1.26, by 2014, if you still have repeated violations of air quality standards in your arena, then you would have to install a monitoring device, or you'd have to convert to electric resurfacing equipment, an electric Zamboni or other resurfacer. So this significantly narrows the bill, because, as I said originally, we wanted every arena to install monitors, and now we're saying only those that are still in violation after the requirement for a catalytic converter has been met and the requirement for training has been met. If they're still in violation of air quality standards, then they need to go this extra step. So I think that's a really big concession on our part, and I think it actually makes really good sense that we're going to just focus these more stringent requirements only on those arenas where there's where there really is a problem and not across the board. Let's see. And then if you move to Section 2 on Page 2, this just gives some direction to the rulemaking process that is still underway, but it's sort of on hold until the legislative process is finished. And we want to make sure that we give a little bit of guidance in a couple of areas. One is that there be posting of information for the public in the arenas about emissions. And secondly, that there be procedures for variances if needed for arenas that could not afford to meet these requirements. And specifications for monitoring devices. And also accommodation for when there's a temporary need to bring in a propane resurfacer. And then finally, the last section is just a report back to the legislature. And the department keeps telling us that they don't have the ability to compile this information without a cost. And we've taken out, we've really streamlined it, and we're not requiring a formal plan. I think the rulemaking will create that plan of action, but I think what we are asking them to report to us is really reasonable, and if they just had an intern or a graduate student, they could easily put this information together, because it's all information that they're already required to collect, and they have been for many years. And basically, just a list of the inspections they've made, what the violations have been, the number of arenas that are exceeding air quality standards. And so we'd like to have that information in the future as we move forward, so that we can monitor this and see how it's working and make sure that the rules that are in place and the laws that are in place are effectively protecting the health of everyone involved in arenas. And we ask them to just post whatever spreadsheet or accumulation of information on their website, because there's a great deal of public interest in knowing more about this, to make sure that people can be sure that their arena is safe. And you haven't seen this, so I don't know if you want to comment. If you want to testify. Madam Chair, could I ask Ms. Davis just to testify briefly? And she is someone who is extremely knowledgeable about these issues. She's a was a professional figure skater with the Ice Capades and a figure skater coach still, and got sick from carbon monoxide poisoning. And she's been a passionate organizer and supporter of the need to make sure that we have the best air quality standards that we can to protect the health of the public. So I'd like to ask Ms. Davis to testify.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Hello, Madam Chair. As you heard, I've been really sick from carbon monoxide in arenas. And the reason this bill was brought forward is because these arenas were doing their jobs. They were testing once a week per the law, and yet I still got sick. And yet many other people got sick. Something is wrong in the process, and therefore this bill was brought forward. Many people have said that I am an isolated case of chronic carbon monoxide poisoning, but in the last few weeks, with the media exposure, many, many people have come forward telling me their stories of also being chronically ill from carbon monoxide in ice arenas. So it is clear that this is a public danger. This is a danger to our children. We need this bill. We need this bill. I mean, we cannot afford to have another event like last year in Morris when more than 20 kids, these are young kids, that went to the hospital for carbon monoxide exposure. This arena was doing their job. They were doing their testing once a week, but that was not adequate. These kids still got sick. So I see this bill. I know there's a lot of changes that has been done. I'm very excited about asking for someone to be trained on site, because last summer I was sick, me and 12 other people, at a rink near here, a very good rink, mind you, and there was no one on staff that could help us. People were falling ill, we were dizzy, and there was nobody on staff to help us. No one didn't even know how to turn on the switch for ventilation. We had to leave the rink. I had to leave the rink because I was so ill I could not stand up. So this is a big deal. This is a big problem. Hockey moms, hockey dads, figure skating moms and dads, they all want to see their children safe in ice arenas, and they're looking to you to do that. I mean, these are your constituents, and they want this. So I want to also speak about fiscal note. I understand that we are always talking about money, about everything, but I am asking you, what is the cost of a child's life? What is it worth to you for a child to be stuck with asthma for the rest of their lives, or to have what I have for the rest of my life? I mean, I have to pay $700 a month currently for oxygen that I have to take every day. So I don't know what the fiscal note is right now. But what I do know is back in 2007, when you great people passed this bill of the freedom to breathe for a smoking ban, there was somehow no need for the health department to hire any additional person. So I'm very confused why we would need additional staff people on for the health department, since when you consider the two, we're talking about only a few hundred ice arenas, and the smoking ban, as you know, we're talking about thousands upon thousands of bars and restaurants, and there was no need for additional staff then. So I would like to push back a little bit on that fiscal note and just put it out there that I don't understand why there would be a cost to the state. There shouldn't be a cost to the state, in my opinion. Again, I'm not an expert. But so I just would like for you to consider, you know, the cost versus the cost of the health of children. I'm sure most of you are parents. I'm sure that if you were in my shoes, you would want to see this pass as well to protect your kids. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Senator Pretner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Anderson, I realize we have a totally new bill in front of us now, and I actually haven't received Duluth's big hockey area. Plus, the Escapades have practiced in Duluth for years and years and years. But I've never heard any complaints. And I have received letters, though, from the hockey arenas, and a long letter. And basically, you know, the comments are impending legislation concerning air quality in ice rinks has good intentions, but the unintended consequences could be the creation of a hardship and a burden on rinks without improving already safe conditions. And I'm just wondering if you have assessed what the cost to the rinks are, because these are government entities oftentimes too, or they're nonprofit hockey associations, and they have a hard time coming up with the additional costs if we're not violating any indoor air quality standards at the current time.
And Madam Chair,
Anderson.
Senator Berglund, that's a really excellent question, and I just want to reinforce that what we've been doing is trying to take away the burden on ice arenas with this amendment, by saying that only those that actually are exceeding air quality standards will have to go through the expensive step of putting a monitor in place or converting to an electric resurfacer. And those are the very expensive propositions that we, in the original bill, we required that of everybody. Well, we required everybody to have a monitor whether or not they were exceeding air quality standards. And now I've narrowed it down so much in this amendment that it only would apply if by 2014 you haven't managed to eliminate your violations of air quality emissions. So I think it's a very reasonable approach that will give them 3 years to do any work they'd have to do on their equipment to upgrade it, on the resurfacing equipment. They wouldn't have to buy new resurfacing equipment. They might have to install a catalytic converter if they haven't done that. That's really the only cost item that we're actually mandating at this point, and that is in the, you know, hundreds of dollars, not thousands of dollars, is my understanding. And most arenas do that anyway. So, you know, the health department keeps telling us that there's, under the current air quality standards, that very few rinks violate those standards. Their proposal is to tighten the standard, I believe, from 30 parts per million for CO, for carbon monoxide, to 25 parts per million. We had proposed in this bill to reduce that to 12.5 parts per million. And I think there's definitely medical and scientific evidence that would support that. I've also taken that out. Even though I would like to have it be the toughest standard possible to, you know, I believe in the precautionary principle that if there's evidence that that could be harmful, especially to children who are engaged in strenuous exercise where they're breathing in and out deeply, we need to have the tightest standards that health would recommend. But we've taken that out because it would put a lot more rinks out of compliance potentially, and it would create more cost to the department as well. So we've taken that out of the bill, and we're just going to leave it up to their rulemaking to set the right health level. So I think we've gone really a very long ways to trying to meet the concerns of the arenas.
Are there any other questions? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Anderson, in preparing for the hearing today, I contacted the Minnesota State High School League, and I attempted to contact the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission because I was interested in hearing more about the issue, and I was not aware, and I'm not yet convinced that this is something that's necessary. I wonder if, and I'm very concerned, I did hear from my community on this issue, and as Senator Prettner-Solon indicated, one of their concerns certainly is the additional costs that would be incurred by the arenas or the hockey association, as it may be. I wonder, Senator Anderson, how many arenas currently have electric equipment? And on line 1.24 of the A10, you referenced this two-hour time period, and I was wondering if there was some evidence to suggest that 2 hours was a good number.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, I'm trying to find my list of, first of all, of the health department's list of people who have been hospitalized for illness because of carbon monoxide poisoning. It's a real issue, and I would just be grateful that it hasn't been occurring in your district. It hasn't occurred in St. Paul that I'm aware of either, and I appreciate that. But it has existed in some places. And so I just want you to be aware this is a very serious issue, and I'm told when the ICE Arena associations get together for their national conferences, their main point of discussion is how to maintain good air quality in these arenas. I think they're very committed to that, but it's a very serious and real issue. And we've had standards in place in Minnesota since the 70s, I think, yeah, on this. So it's not something I'm just making up out of the blue. It's a real health issue, and I think everybody is trying their best to respond to it, but we're just seeing that there's a few holes that perhaps we should tighten it up a little bit and try to guide this in a little bit stronger direction to protect, make sure everyone's health is protected. On the issue of the electric resurfacers, I think only about 20 arenas, is that what, have them at this point out of maybe 200 in Minnesota. And again, I just want to reinforce that with this amendment, we're not requiring, the only people that would be required to either get a monitor or get an electric resurfacer are those who are violating the air quality standards 4 years from now. So nobody else would be required to under this bill. And so I just want to be really clear about that. I would really like it if the industry would move towards electric resurfacers. And I think some of them are trying to do that, but it's expensive, and so that will take time. And we're not mandating that. We're saying by 2014, if you're still repeatedly and significantly violating air quality standards, you have to put a monitor in or you have to get an electric resurfacer. So I just want to be clear that this requirement would only affect the arenas that aren't solving this problem, which is already required by current law. And then the 2 hours, do you want to speak to that?
Yep. I did.
Ms. Davis?
Yes, I'm sorry.
And maybe just emphasize, this is talking about other than, this is a narrow thing for, maybe I'll just say that to start with. Mm-hmm. Lines 1.22 to 1.25, I just want to be clear, that's not a general rule for your average hockey game. This 2 hours only applies for if you're using some other kind of internal combustion equipment. Is that the right term? Internal combustion engine in an arena, like sometimes happens when there's a construction project going on or when they come in at the beginning of the season and put up the boards and the glass, they have to run some equipment. And so we just want, and so that's caused some problems on occasion where we just want to make sure that the air is cleared out before someone comes in and skates after those other kinds of equipment are brought into an arena. So this says equipment other than ice resurfacing or ice edging. So this isn't part of the standard everyday grooming of the ice that relates to.
Other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Anderson. I'm really interested in this because, as you know, in Bemidji, we're just in the process of building a new convention center that's going to include a large hockey rink. And so I know you've touched on this a bit, but I'm just wondering, because I'm guessing I'm going to have a discussion locally with, as new equipment is being purchased and we're in the process of completing that project, really what are the differences in costs? More specifically, the cost of monitoring air quality, I think you said a lot of that is already happening now, mm-hmm. but is there likely to be an additional requirement for the monitoring, or is it going to really just be the same as what they're already doing? And then specifically the cost of, you know, perhaps getting an electric, these are, I think we call them Zamboni-type machines. Are they the same in terms of the amount of time it takes to resurface and the quality of resurfacing they do? And just more information about. If you have that available, I don't need to have it here all in the committee during the committee time, but I'd really appreciate as much detail as is available about that kind of information. And then the last point I was going to ask about is, you know, we already have standards during construction, and I know that the carbon monoxide emissions for some construction projects can be really dangerous. I've had personal knowledge of cases where people have died because of exposure to these carbon emissions. But I know that we also have requirements in place under law that we're supposed to be monitoring that. Is there a reason to, during that construction process, to treat hockey rinks different than any other construction project in terms of the need for that? Or would the laws we already have in place governing that already kind of encompass that?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, those are a lot of good questions. Let me try to address them one at a time. I think the cost for an electric resurfacer, Zamboni is a brand name, so it's not the only type, but it's commonly used, is around $100,000, and I think a propane one is more like
60, 70,000,
is that? Yeah, I'm looking at your chart trying to.
It would be
123,000 versus 82,000? Okay, this is. So it is more, it's, you know, what, maybe 25, 30% more costly to get an electric one, upfront cost. And I don't know what your new arena would be planning. A lot of newer construction does include some kind of monitoring device. Right now, under the current rules, what the arenas have to do is once a week they have to go out on the ice with these tubes. So it's a very sort of manual process and test what the emissions are right after the resurfacing equipment is done. And then they write that down and submit it to the health department. And so what we're looking for is something that is, you know, as I said, a real-time monitor that's electronic. And a few arenas have those installed now, and they're in, you know, the cost is a range that I've heard from $5,000 to $7,000 or something like that. So there's a cost, a significant cost, but it's doable.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
So, Senator Anderson, is that just kind of like a large-scale carbon monoxide detector type of thing that they, like a commercial grade, or like similar to what we have in homes, or is it something a lot beyond that?
Do you want to talk about
it? Madam Chair, Senator Olson. The detectors were shown to us yesterday in a stakeholder meeting. That's why I can speak about that. But the detectors do detect three types of gases. And they are a little bit different than from what we have in our homes because they have to be able to withstand humidity and so on. And actually, most of the detectors shown to us yesterday, they not only detect carbon monoxide, nitrogen dioxide, carbon dioxide, but they also detect humidity levels and things that are helpful for an ice arena to know. But they are different than what we have in our homes.
And, Madam Chair, we do have some, as I mentioned, some time here for the health department to look at that equipment and evaluate as part of their rulemaking what, or over time, even in the next couple of years, what that equipment exactly should look like, because there's a lot of discussion about that. You also mentioned the construction equipment, and I believe in most cases that's covered by OSHA standards. And so I think this is just a specific requirement for ice skaters to make sure that because they're not workers, they wouldn't be covered under OSHA standards, presumably. So that's why we want to make sure that, you know, the workers would be covered by the OSHA standards who are doing the construction, but make sure that the skaters are also protected and so that there's a time period there to allow for the adequate air exchange.
Are there other questions? We do have another witness who wants to testify. Senator Lynch?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question. Senator Anderson, can you clarify, does the Minnesota Department of Health currently has standards that are in place that monitor this air quality. So is it your assertion that the standards are not adequate or that they're not being enforced? I'm trying to understand a little bit more about what's behind this. And it's been suggested to me that the Department of Health is currently reviewing those standards. Can you comment on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, absolutely. And I've discussed this a little bit already, that they're currently in a rulemaking process. They already have standards in place and a current set of rules. So they're already required to test once a week with their tubes. They already have a standard, which is 30 parts per million of carbon monoxide under current rules. The health department had proposed tightening that standard to 25 parts per million. As I mentioned earlier, we thought it really should be lower than that to protect the health of people who are exercising, especially children. But we've dropped that from the bill and just are going to let the health department decide what the latest standards should be. So they're already proposing tightening the standards. They are. This is a very, very poorly funded program. And I'll be the first to agree with the health department. They don't have enough money to adequately enforce this. So they have one person, I believe, they've told us, that goes around the state, and maybe once every 2 years they're able to go to one arena and check in. And then they get these reports mailed into them quarterly based on the weekly testing. So there is a program in place, and again, there's a rulemaking process underway. We just want to give a little guidance to make sure that some elements are included either in law or in the new rules so that we can have a little bit of a tighter program in place, because we know there, even with the current rules in place, there have been, I found my list, you know, people who have gotten sick from carbon monoxide poisoning. So we just want to make sure the rules and the laws are really working to protect health. So we're trying to work with the health department on this, and I think they're trying to do their best with a very, very limited budget. And obviously we can't increase that budget at this time.
Are there other questions? Okay, then Joel Carlson wanted to testify.
Just stay up here. Yeah, we'll let him sit here. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's been a long time since I've had an excursion into the Human Services Committee. Madam Chair and members, my name is Joel Carlson, and since 2003, I've been a member of the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission, and we operate the largest indoor ice facility in the country. And in addition to spending a significant amount of time on this bill, this session, I spend a significant amount of time in hockey arenas. I've been a youth coach for 17 years. I've been playing hockey since I was four in Center Solon. This past weekend, I had a chance to play in the New Heritage Arena. What an awesome facility. I want you to know that arenas right now are currently in compliance with the health department requirements relative to air quality. And the excursions that we have had and the acute incidents that have happened in Minnesota have been the result of human error. And there isn't a regulation that we're going to put in place that is going to completely eliminate human error from causing an excursion above the air quality limits. I just, like everyone else, just got this amendment and just have a couple of points that I'd like to make and then conclude with the resolution that the Amateur Sports Commission passed yesterday. But as to the amendment, I want the members to know that as to retrofitting, what I've learned about ice resurfacing equipment and edgers over the past few weeks is that the retrofit that is required on lines 1.18 to 1.21 is either impossible, technologically infeasible, or would have the ability to void your warranty on your expensive equipment by adding aftermarket catalytic converters. We don't think that we could comply with that requirement, which would cause us to purchase new equipment. There isn't a Zamboni made, Zamboni as the generic term, that has not been made with a catalytic converter since 2003. And most of the new edgers have approved catalytic converters on them. but retrofitting existing edgers, which they cost about $7,000 a piece, is technologically not feasible. We also have concerns about the terminology significantly and repeatedly exceeds the air quality standards. There isn't an arena in the state that significantly or repeatedly violates the standards. These are all the ones that we're aware of have been acute instances, and there isn't a single arena that would meet that, although I would, you know, try to point out that that is certainly not a bright line for a regulator to know what is and is outside the rules. When you're calling the balls and strikes, we don't know what significantly and repeatedly means relative to this standard. Also, Madam Chair and members, would like you to know that the continuous and calibrated air monitoring equipment that is discussed in 1.30, there isn't a single approved continuous monitoring system right now in Minnesota. The health department has not approved any because there isn't any that have been any better or approvable because of how they capture the air samples in center ice. And there just isn't an approved method right now for a continuous monitoring system of air quality. There are some that are on the market. There are some that are being reviewed by the Department of Health, but there are none that are currently approved by them. So it's a requirement that right now there isn't technology available to comply with. We've had a lengthy meeting yesterday with arena operators and other stakeholders, and I think operators are very aware of the issue and believe that the health department, through their current rulemaking process, can develop training protocols and licensing for arena operators so that we have an operator on site that understands the importance of monitoring and keeping track of their air quality. And yesterday, the Amateur Sports Commission asked the legislature by resolution to allow the Department of Health to continue their rulemaking process, which they indicate will be done in December of 2010. And that the legislature not take action on this bill until after the Department of Health has rewritten their rules. And for the cost for us at the Amateur Sports Commission, if we need to purchase new electric resurfacing equipment, that's over $1 million expenditure for us. The continuous air monitoring, which is not even approved by the health department, would cost us in excess of $50,000 for all 8 of our sheets. And so there is a significant cost to arena operators from the requirements of the bill that we're concerned about. And that is not to say, and just want everyone to know, that all of the operators believe that the health and safety of our fans and our participants is our top priority. But no one right now is out of compliance in a way that, absent operator error, that these requirements are going to address. And so we'd ask you to let the health department to complete their work, and we're happy to participate in that, but that we don't wade into this without having, you know, people that are above my pay grade help set these rules. So with that, Madam Chair and members, happy to answer questions that you might have.
Senator Coring, do you have a question for Mr. Carlson?
No, Madam Chair, I have a motion. I move that Senate File 3175 be tabled.
Well, we were going to lay it over anyway. We don't have a fiscal note on it, so...
accept my motion to table.
Well, a motion like that is in order at any time. I think we're going to lay it over anyway, which accomplishes the same thing. So,
well, Madam Chair, I know this isn't a debate, but I'd sure like a chance to respond to Mr. Carlson before you would vote on that motion. I think that would only be a matter of
Would that be acceptable to you, Senator, to withdraw your motion so Senator Anderson can make a comment?
Well, actually, it's a non-debatable motion, but I...
Well, that's why I'm asking if you'll withdraw it temporarily.
I guess I'll withdraw it temporarily, but, you know, what I'm saying is I'm not saying to lay it over. I'm actually saying to table it, so it's tabled until we take it off the table again. So I'll withdraw that.
Madam Chair, you know, I'm not sure why Mr. Carlson repeats the same thing in another committee that he's repeating here today, which is just not true. It's very frustrating, and I don't make that allegation lightly. I don't think I've ever said that in a committee hearing in 18 years. Mr. Carlson said there's no carbon dioxide monitors that are approved or in operation The Blaine Arena that the Amateur Sports Commission runs has four of them installed. And I said that at the last committee, and my staff called the arena to check. And they told us, they confirmed that. And so I really don't understand why he's trying to confuse people and say they don't exist when the arena that his organization runs has installed them in their new rinks, on their new ice sheets. Now, as I understand it, the Blaine Arena has some old ice without them, and the four new rinks have the ventilation and CO monitors installed. And they haven't been approved by the health department. That part is true.
That's the point.
Oh, okay. So what Mr. Carlson was saying, they are in use. They have them, but they haven't been approved by the health department, which is why we have a bill that asks the health department to put standards in place, because they don't have any standards yet for these. That's why we have a bill. And it makes no sense to just let the rulemaking finish and then do a bill, because that would be a waste of everybody's time, money, and resources. The point is, we want to give some guidance to this process. We support what the Department of Health is doing, but we want to make sure that our concerns for safety are also met. That's why we have this bill, and we want them to incorporate these ideas as they move forward in the rulemaking. And they've told us that they've had to put it on hold because of this legislative discussion, which is very understandable, and that they intend to go back to their stakeholder discussions. And they've even told us that all the media and attention that's been given to this legislation will help them get a broader discussion than they've been able to get, because sometimes rulemakings don't attract a lot of attention, and now it will. And they'll have enough participation to really get everyone at the table, which I think is good for everyone. And so, Madam Chair, I'm a little frustrated about this discussion.
Madam Chair and members, the point is that there isn't an approved continuous monitoring system, which means we have to duplicate the existing tests that are required by the rule and install the continuous monitoring system, which every arena in the state would have to do.
No,
that
not
is
under this bill.
No, you didn't read the bill correctly.
Madam Chair, let me just
Let's
also...
Let's go through the chair, please.
Apologize.
Okay. And right now, Mr. Carlson has the floor.
And Madam Chair, we're not saying that there isn't some technology to provide continuous monitoring. The point that we're making is that it is not approved by the Department of Health, so that does not give us, as a regulated entity, the ability to demonstrate that we're in compliance, because we do not have a technology that is approved by them, that is recognized by their rules for demonstrating that we're in compliance. We still have to go out weekly and perform the tests, which we're all doing, and we're all in compliance. We've never had a spike at the Amateur Sports Commission. But what I'm saying is that this method of monitoring is not currently approved by the Department of Health. And that
Carlson,
is what my point is.
Is there a reason to believe that the monitoring system that you have would not meet the Department of Health standards if they developed a standard for that?
Madam Chair and members, I think that's exactly why the Amateur Sports Commission asked to allow the Department of Health to complete their rulemaking process, so that we know that it will be approved. We don't know that right now, and we still do weekly tests as required by the Department of Health. And so that's our point, is that they are going through the process of rewriting these rules. We're participating in that, but right now there is not an approved continuous monitoring that will demonstrate that we are in compliance. That's the point that arena operators are trying to make to the committee.
Senator Anderson, one last comment, and then we're going to do something here.
Madam Chair, I'm failing to understand why Mr. Carlson's organization installed monitors that he says are not approved, but he doesn't want them to be approved. I'm not sure why they invested in them if they don't think they're effective. The health department's proposed rules do not have standards for monitors. That's why we introduced this bill. The health department wasn't going down that road. We want them to have standards. That's one of the things that's still in here. But to correct Mr. Carlson, he wouldn't have to install them unless his rink is out of compliance with air quality standards 4 years from now. And so the bill, the amendment, and I know a lot of people haven't had time to really absorb what's in here, but we've been trying to respond to these concerns, and that's why the amendment says only if you fail to protect children's health and you have 4 years to do it, then you have to install a monitor or you have to get an electric resurfacer, and not otherwise. So I just want to be clear. This is narrow. This is reasonable. This is a compromise. And I'm very frustrated at the misinformation that you're hearing today. We understand that the Blaine Arena had a spike, according to someone's test last week, and I don't know. We could debate that all day. But.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, I would move that Senate file 3175 be tabled.
Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
I believe the ayes have it, but let's do a division.
They're just louder. What are you asking?
We're doing a division. Those in favor, raise your hands. Those opposed, raise your hands. The nays have it. So we'll just lay this over, Senator Anderson, and we're not going to adopt the amendment because you might have another one by the time we actually get back to you.
Madam Chair, thank you very much for your time.
If you do have another one, we'd like you to have a fiscal note when you come to the committee.
We'll make sure of that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Dahl.
Morning, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, what we have before us is the Senate File 3094 is on our health plans. There was a commission or a report we did a couple years ago that directed the Commissioner of Health to do a report to the legislature on guidelines and recommendations. For intended to ensure some consistency in reporting of administrative expenses and interest income or investment income. And they produced that report and from that made some recommendations that would be the next steps. And the bill before us is those next steps. One of them is to establish an advisory group that would be able to develop the recommendations further. And to be able to be able to consolidate a lot of this administrative expenses in a uniform way. There's a lot of wide variation amongst the health plans and the county-based purchasing organizations with how they report these things. We want to consolidate them so we have a better understanding of where this money is going. All of them have some validity as far as how they're done, but we'd like some uniformity to that. And we've put this bill together that would allow the Department of Health to contract with an outside contractor or consultant to help them with this process. And that's what's generated a fiscal note on this. We have worked with the stakeholders to kind of modify the language and what they would be required to do in the time frame that would result in a reduction in the fiscal note. We have an agreement with the different parties that this would make sense as a next step. The one complication that we do see is with this health plan, the national health plan reforms.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask about that today.
They, there are some recommendations that they're going to be coming out with that do some of the same things on some uniformity on methodologies, and they've asked now the states to submit recommendations to the Department of HHS and Commerce and Labor as well to as they formulate their recommendations and then submit them back to the states by the end of this year. We don't know what that's going to look like, the Department of Health is not sure if that's going to be fairly prescriptive or if there's going to be some flexibility, if it's just going to be guidelines, but that's due by the end of this year. There's still a general feeling that the advisory group could still move ahead, being cautious that some of the things that they may do
may need to be repeated, possibly because of what comes out of from Washington. But you know, there's a degree of risk, I guess, that may occur. But nonetheless, that I think that we've got a start date of September 1st of this year of starting the group, and those recommendations would be issued by the end of December. So it's 4 months that they could be doing some work. I think there's still some preliminary work that would need to be done. There's also the feeling that the state may want to do something even more detailed and prescriptive than what the federal government would be requiring. So there's still things that they could do. But in the recommendations, I did put together an amendment to revise the language in here to adjust what would be required out of the advisory group so that the outside consultant wouldn't have to do as much work, and that would substantially reduce the fiscal note associated with this bill.
So do we have an amendment?
Yes, we have an A3 amendment. Oh, it's A4, excuse me, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I'll
so
invite,
there is an oral amendment, I understand, needed to this amendment, so I'll recognize Mr. Giel to read it to us.
Madam Chair, on the A4 amendment, 1.5, delete purchasers and insert purchasing plans.
Senator Lynch, would you like to move adoption of the amendment with the oral addition incorporated?
So moved.
Thank you. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor of the A4 amendment say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I'll just briefly explain, if I could, what the adjustment here is again, initially we were having the advisory group develop a detailed standards and procedures for examining the reasonableness of administrative expenses for publicly funded programs. And part of that would also be including developing a reporting template. And at this point, with the amendment, what it does is that they simply are making recommendations for the development of consistent guidelines and reporting requirements. But they will develop that reporting template, and that will be where a lot of the expense will be in developing that template. But at this point, taking out the detailed standards and procedures portion of it, that's what was costing a lot of the dollars in the fiscal note.
So is there someone here from the Department of Health that could answer a few questions?
Good morning, Madam Chair. Jim Golden.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Golden. I'm wondering if you can tell us how will you make a recommendation to the federal government about what you think would be reasonable standards in this area if this bill isn't adopted?
Madam Chair, committee members, maybe it would be helpful to talk just a little bit about what is in the federal bill, what was released yesterday, and what is likely to happen, I think, with that. So as
if you would please do that.
As part of the federal bill, there is a requirement around the minimum loss ratios that require plans that serve the individual and group markets to meet certain loss ratios. And one of the requirements on the Secretary of HHS is to define three categories of information that must be reported by all health plans. The first is the amount of dollars that are spent on the reimbursement of clinical services. The second is the dollars that are spent on activities that improve healthcare quality. And then the third is on all other non-claims costs, including an explanation of the nature of these costs, excluding taxes and regulatory fees. And so what happened yesterday is the Department of Treasury, Labor, and HHS issued a joint call for comments in anticipation of their rulemaking activity. And so one of the requirements in the bill is that the NAIC is to establish uniform definitions across each of those three categories, including standardized methodologies for calculating the categories within those activities. And so HHS is required to promulgate their federal rules by the end of this calendar year, because starting in 2011, the plans are required to start reporting that. And it's an actually quite important to the plans, because that is also related to if they don't meet the loss ratios, there is the rebate requirements that are in the federal bill. And so right now what the federal government is doing is asking for comments in anticipation of their rules. That is a 30-day period. We would anticipate that many of the stakeholders might very well submit comments as part of that to help influence that rule writing. They will then promulgate their rules, and I would anticipate probably a 60-day comment period, as would be the standard for federal rules. I would anticipate that there will be quite a lot of discussion to think about how what they are doing in their federal rules relates to what we are doing. I think, as Senator Dahl said, I think there's some question. Clearly, NAIC is required to provide to HHS standardized methodologies for calculating that. I think what we see in Minnesota today is that plans are calculating things in an actuarially sound method within their plan, but you still get a fair amount of variation. So it's a little bit unclear to us at this point the level of specificity that will be in the rules. Will they simply at the federal level say, you must calculate it exactly this way? Or will they say, you need to calculate it in an actuarially sound way, which would include this family, in which case a state might want to have more specificity associated with that?
So, Mr. Golden, would it be your opinion that it would be better if we pass this bill to make a start date of December so that more of the federal standards would be known to the group that would be working on trying to improve them? Or
Madam Chair, committee members, I think by waiting until we at least see the federal rules, I think it greatly reduces the risk that we do unnecessary work through the summer and fall. Because I think we will, when those rules are published, have a much better understanding of whether or not there is anything that needs to be done. So, for example, are the rules adequately defined, or do the federal rules put into a framework which we must work within? So I think that's what I would describe as the risk there and opportunities.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure how I feel about the time frame. The concern I have, and this is why I really commend Senator Dahl for moving ahead with this effort, because it became very clear during the year, a few years ago, when we were working on healthcare reform, that it was extremely difficult to get a straight answer out of anybody about what was being considered an administrative cost. And the reason that this is so important and the loss ratio issue, I mean, basically we're talking about how much money is of the dollars that we spend on health care is actually going to pay for that care versus how much is being retained by the insurance health plan entity that we perhaps could have been using to pay for health care, and making sure that we're accountable to the public for how those dollars are being spent. And I know that's what Senator Dahl's bill is intended to get at. So, for example, in some cases, the cost of reinsurance, which is basically insulating the insurance, the health plan from risk, was being considered a medical expense rather than an administrative cost. The cost of doing pre-approvals of care was considered not an administrative cost because it was viewed as part of the scenario of deciding what the appropriate care was. And so it was looked at as a care delivery cost as opposed to an administrative cost, even though you know, it wasn't going to pay directly for care, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then that did not even count the administrative costs that the physicians and hospitals had in complying with all the requirements that the health plans put in place for billing and so forth and pre-approval. And one doctor estimated that over 30% of the cost of his practice was going toward all of that kind of compliance, which is his administrative cost, which gets built into the system. So I think it's extremely important that we get a handle on defining this as narrowly as possible so that we can really get at where these costs are where these dollars are being spent, and then I do think that states are going to have, as a general principle at least, the ability to be more consumer protection oriented if we choose to do that, even though we will get a framework from the federal government, and we can't be out of compliance with that framework, but we can certainly drill down, I think, in a more detailed way if we choose to do that.
So, Senator Dahl, how do you feel about having this work begin in December instead of September as you have in your bill?
Madam Chair, I like to move forward on this advisory group, but I do have that caution about some of the stuff that is going to come down from the federal government, and I don't think a 3-month delay is going to make or break the results of this, and it'll certainly keep us from having to do duplicative work. We get into that month of December, and now that's the holidays. And then no work gets done anyway, so I'm a little concerned. I think there's some work that can be done prior that they're getting things set up so that they're ready
Senator
to move
Dahl,
ahead.
I have gotten a lot of work done in the month of December.
Well,
this past December, as a matter of fact. Well, let me just ask the department: would it change the fiscal note if we change the date?
Madam Chair, committee members, I think with what we know today, it would not change the fiscal note, but if we had more information once the federal rules are out, it may very well, at that point, have some effect.
So, Senator Dahl, I'm also thinking perhaps if we can find money for this project, perhaps it should come out of the Healthcare Access Fund. That way, if you don't need all of it, it would just revert back to the fund if it isn't used.
Okay.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And kind of along those lines about with regard to the fiscal note, and Senator Dahl, maybe this is a question for you. In the absence of this bill, what I'm hearing today from the department and as a result of the federal legislation is that there is in fact going to be work done at the state level on this issue. And so as we heard the testimony from the department that, you know, we're waiting for further guidance and to see what the parameters are, is at that point in time, is the department going to come back to the division and ask for additional monies in order to implement these federal guidelines? Is one question that I have, or what? I'm not sure why the fiscal note is necessary, and I'm not sure, in fact, why the bill is necessary if, in fact, there's guidance coming and this is part of the federal reform measure. Can we accomplish this without this bill and without expending these dollars? I guess is kind of where I'm thinking.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch.
Senator Dahl.
This was the recommendations that came out of the original report and is a part of what the Commissioner of Health is suggesting that we take the next step was to develop an advisory group. That's a big part of this, to direct where we go from here. And I don't believe that we want to simply take the prescription from federal legislation, say that's as far as we want to take it. I think we're take what we have within our state, develop the guidelines we think are appropriate, are meaningful to us as we go forward with our own health care reforms within the state. When obviously this makes it a little different that we have to, with the reforms that have been done, to change, you know, modify how we think about it, but we still want to move forward with our own specifics in Minnesota. And so the department has suggested that they need to have additional outside services to make it a fair, you know, report, so it doesn't seem like it's biased in any way coming from one, either the health plans or from the department itself, that having this outside consultant will help to provide that fairness in the reporting and legitimacy in the process. So that's their recommendation, and that's why we have the fiscal note included with this.
Mr. Golden, could you explain to us, we've gotten a fiscal note from Commerce as well as from the Department of Health, and both of you are using actuarial assistance in this bill, and I'm really wondering if you both need to be doing that and which one we should be looking toward doing this part of the work.
Madam Chair, committee members, I can certainly explain what the Department of Health's actuary is for. I think Commerce might be here because there may very well be some overlap. With regard to what the Department of Health would use the actuary for, is I think that the purpose of this bill is really to look at the administrative side of the expense in more detail. So the real purpose is, if you think about a grid, you have product lines going across the top, and then down the side you have functional categories such as billing and enrollment, claims processing, customer service, underwriting, and other activities. And so right now the plans all are required to report their information in those various cells of that table. And undoubtedly, all of them are using actuarially sound methods, but some of those methods vary quite substantially in how they allocate costs. So while it's consistent with their accounting systems and they're not doing anything wrong, you could still get greater consistency by using one set of actuarial methods. And so when you bring the work group together, undoubtedly each of the plans are going to advocate for some of their actuarial methods, thinking that they are better. Some of those methods might be impacted by the type of accounting that you're doing. They might be impacted by the size of your plan, and some other characteristics. And what we would be using the actuary for is to help us in a neutral way try to assess the information that we and recommendations that we are receiving from plans that are doing a similar activity but in slightly different ways. And so we thought it would be quite helpful to have that neutral party to help us understand the pros and cons of different allocation methods.
Is there someone here from the Department of Commerce?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Gross. I'm with the Department of Commerce. If I understand what Commerce's fiscal note is about, is currently the Commerce Department has an interagency agreement with the Department of Health, and the function of that interagency agreement is to assist the Health Department when we look at the financial solvency of the HMOs that they regulate along with the counties and bearing the risk. We also have this part of this interagency agreement is dealing with rate review and stuff like that. What our fiscal note is designed to do is we have this interagency agreement. Within that agreement is allocated dollars for us to help the health department out. What we're anticipating is using some of those dollars from this interagency agreement that's already there to fund and help the health department with this study.
So is that the same actuary that the Department of Health would be using through the interagency agreement with the Department of Commerce, Mr. Golden?
Madam Chair, it sounds the same to me. I don't know if we would actually use our interagency with the Department of Commerce or whether it would be more appropriate to use an outside one. I guess it's just literally the expertise that they have, but it does sound to me as if it is the same function.
Well, the Department of Commerce at least has their actuary paid for through the Special Revenue Fund.
By the Department of Health.
It's paid for by the Department of Health, but at least we're not paying for it twice.
Madam Chair, members, this Barb Julich, Department of Health, it would be the same money. So, for example, if the $39,000 was appropriated to the Department of Health, transferred to Commerce becomes a revenue in their Special Revenue Fund, then they expend it out of the Special Revenue Fund. So it's the same money.
Okay. Thank you very much for that clarification. Senator Erickson-Robes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Dahl, to the question about the membership on the advisory group, not a question about when they would begin, but who that group is. I think there's a little bit of a gap here. I'm looking through your advisory group membership, and it seems like, to begin with, you know, you have all the commissioners there, and that's really good to have those folks on board because they're the authority that oversee all the money that's being spent and these programs that are being delivered. And then you also include the health plans and HMOs and county-based purchasing groups, and they're the people that actually get paid to deliver the service. There is a mention here about some providers like hospital physicians, but the group I see missing are related to consumers. Are there any consumer groups or people who would advocate for the people being served by some of these health plans or county-based organizations? I'm a big fan of the stakeholder approach, and I believe that everyone who's going to be affected by a decision needs to be part of the decision. So I'm wondering on this advisory board, a couple things is under other healthcare providers, if you might also would consider user advocates or consumer groups or things like that. For example, we often have ombudsmen representing families and residents on nursing home councils. There's always, you know, a family council is a part of this. I really think we need to have somebody in part of this discussion that represents the consumer.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Erickson-Ropes, I'm always in favor of having as much consumer protection and involvement as possible. On this particular bill, this was a lot of the inside baseball, the people who are dealing with things that, need the financial expertise to understand where these things go and have that background. I didn't see in most of the conversations we've had with stakeholders that there was a need to place someone on this particular advisory committee or group for that reason, that they would basically be an observer, a witness, instead of someone that was a participating member. That was the reason we didn't really put anybody else besides these particular groups in there.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just following up on that thought as just perhaps between now and the bill's next stop, just to think
this
about.
This is the bill's next
this
stop. The
this is the bill's last stop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I guess I'm just wondering, Senator Dahl, if you would be willing to entertain the thought of who that person might be. Because when we're talking about administrative costs, there are also those costs, even if we don't measure them and even if they're not direct, for consumers who are trying to get their health care paid, and also for employers who are interacting with the health plans and choosing health care coverages and just the things that they have to do. And so even if they're not as knowledgeable on the inside baseball aspect of this as you're talking about, they might be able to offer some wisdom to the group about those costs that they bear, whether in time or direct financial expense, in the whole scenario of how our healthcare gets paid. And, just raise those issues and points for So they may not have the same expertise as the people you already have here, but they may have a different point of view that does have some value.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that same point, Senator Dahl, about the inside baseball piece and levels of expertise, I guess I'm not willing to just preclude an entire group of people as consumers as not being smart enough to be, you know, participants on this advisory board. There may very well be people who are actuaries themselves or financial experts who are also consumers or consumer advocates for people who get this health care. So, you know, again, bringing back to a consumer advocate, you know, we could designate someone perhaps, to your point, if I would concede that, get someone from legal aid. They certainly have the expertise and resources to deal with that same kind of questions, and they're representing the consumers.
Madam Chair, I don't have any objections to adding someone like that onto this bill if someone wants to propose an amendment to the bill.
Well, I think I'd like to first of all get the dates straightened out here so that we're not using up a lot of resources before we know where we're at with this federal rulemaking. So why don't we see if we can get an oral amendment to change the date?
Madam Chair, I would suggest on page 1, line 19, push it back the effective date of Section 1 until January 1, 2013. Because the plans have to use the template that won't be available on January 1, 2012. And then on page 2, line 21, push back the appointments to the group until November 1, 2010. And on 2.24, have the first meeting of the advisory group by December 1, 2010.
Madam Chair, I'll make those amendments.
Senator Kretner Solon moves that amendment.
Madam Chair, if I might just interject one thing. If we're looking at dates, if we go down to 2031, then, I mean, given the time frame that we're looking at, is that enough time for, and I'm not sure that if we're compressing all this, if we shouldn't push that out a little bit too, for the recommendations, at least a month. I don't know that 6 weeks is enough time for them to. Right, you know, 2 months is enough time.
It's over a year. It's 2012.
Oh, excuse me. I apologize. Yeah, you're right.
So I think
it's... never mind. Thank you.
Any further discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Are there any other amendments? Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back then to the membership, that would be beginning on line 2.10. If I can do this orally, we'd have to make a change actually on 2.11. Instead of 9, change it to 10. And then drop down to line 2.20 below, or change the period to a comma, and then add, or semicolon, I guess, and then add the Roman numeral 4 in parentheses, consumer advocate.
Change
the reason. Is that
everything? Change it to 6.
Council members?
Change it to 6.
Number 6.
Does the staff have that language?
Yeah.
Well, Madam Chair, if you want to do it that way, you'd have to change on 2.17. You'd have 4 members appointed by the Commissioner of Health. Or you could have a clause 6, which would just be, would come after line 2.20 and be a number 6, and it would be 1 member appointed by the Commissioner to represent consumers.
Okay. Madam Chair, the last recommendations, I think, would make most sense, number 6, adding a number 6.
Okay, Senator Erickson Ropes makes that motion.
Madam Chair, could someone restate the amendment, please?
Mr. Gill, do you want to restate the amendment?
Sure. The whole thing on 2.11, change 9 to 10. And then after line 2.20, you'd have a number 6, 1 member appointed by the Commissioner of Health to represent consumers.
Okay. Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor of that amendment say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Madam Chair, I do have one other amendment that when there's oh, it's appropriate to...
Well, I would say we're running.
Okay. This is along with administrative expenses to look at. It's something that's brought to me just recently, and it's on the amount of reporting that the health plans have to do. They've started to calculate that there's over 1,000 reports, many of them duplicative, that they have to submit. And if you break that down in a regular work week, it comes out to about one report per every 2 hours of work time. And we feel that there's a way to go through those, comb through those, and find a way to consolidate those reports. The amendment that I have would have the health plans in themselves actually submitting a report or recommendations to the Commissioner of Health on what they believe are the ones that are duplicative, and then having the commissioner submit that to the legislature. And if they choose, they may provide recommendations in addition to that, you know, if they wanted to. But though the cost would be borne by the health plans themselves. And that's the A.
If we have the amendment, maybe we could get
it's distributed. It's the A3 amendment. I'm sorry, Madam
and
Chair.
And then I could see if someone from the Department of Health could come back up to the table. Thank you, Mr. Golden. Would this amendment have an additional fiscal cost?
Madam Chair, committee members, this appears to be a requirement on the plans in county-based purchasing. The only requirement on the commissioners would be to submit it to the legislature along with any comments or recommendations. I guess I note, ironically, this is a request for yet another report that the plans would be required to do, a report on reports. that irony notwithstanding, the other only other comment that I would have is with regard to what they might put together. I don't know the quality or accuracy of it, and I think that the departments would want to take a look at those when those come in. But given that the bulk of the work is on the plans and not the department, I don't think we would anticipate a fiscal note with this.
Well, and maybe if we can eliminate some of these reports, we could actually reduce their administrative mm-hmm. allocation. Mm-hmm. A lot of these are federal, however, I note. So.
Madam Chair, I anticipate with this, the new reforms, we'll probably get a whole slew of new reports that need to be done.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
I'd move the A3 amendment.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Now, Senator Dahl, I'd like to have someone move for you that Senate File 3094 is amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
I'd like Senator to make Olson. That motion, Senator Burton. Madam Chair.
Senator Olson has made the motion. Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Members, Senate File 3201.
Madam Chair, I have an amendment for this bill. This is a bill that has been drafted to find a way to continue funding our controlled substance registration program in the department, in the at the Board of Pharmacy. It was started with a federal grant that we authorized them to apply for. And so it's started up, but it needs to have some ongoing funding. And the original way we had it funded was somewhat controversial with some of the stakeholders, so we've worked with them to come up with a different method of funding it, and that would be in the A7 amendment. The A7 amendment would provide that the boards of podiatric medicine, optometry, pharmacy, medical practice, nursing, and dentistry would each be assessed part of their special revenue toward providing funding for the ongoing operation of this project. This project is a valuable one in that it helps these types of providers to know when they're writing a prescription that this person isn't prescription shopping and isn't going from drugstore to drugstore. We have examples that Mr. Weiberg can give you of just in the short time the system has been up of the examples of people that really are either selling these drugs or are very addicted to these drugs. So I'd like to move the A7 amendment so we can be discussing and working off of it.
Members, the A7 was included in your packet. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor of the A7 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A7 is adopted. Senator Berglund.
I think I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Weiberg now.
Mr. Weiberg, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. And the prescription monitoring program, as we're calling it now, does monitor controlled substance prescriptions, or at least most of them, in Schedules 2, 3, and 4. These are the most addictive controlled substances. There is a definite problem with prescription drug abuse in the country and in the state. I didn't bring it here, but in the policy committee, I presented I had a presentation that went over some of the facts and figures. And in the last decade, the abuse of prescription drugs has gone up significantly. It's a statewide problem. And the number of deaths has gone up in the metro area. And because of that, we actually have a medical examiner who's working with us now because she, frankly, it was Dr. Lindsay Thomas down in Dakota County, is frankly tired of dealing with the number of prescription overdose deaths that she's seeing. We did, in fact, apply for a federal grant. We received the federal grant. It was for $200,000 per year. Turns out that's not quite enough to actually fund the program, we're finding. We do work with a vendor, and most of the expense of the program goes to the vendor. There is some expense that we're having for the staff that we need to process the applications from the physicians and prescribers that want to use the system. The proposed mechanism for funding the program on an ongoing basis, because we do run out of that grant money later this year, is to have the Board of Pharmacy, which licenses pharmacists, and then each of the boards that license prescribers to pay a portion of the cost based on the percentage of the total number of prescribers and pharmacists that they happen to license. And the costs are the total cost for fiscal year 2011 are $517,000, and then the base funding after that would be $356,000. There's a one-time cost in the first year to pay both the vendor that we're using for our prescription monitoring program and the vendor that we use for our licensing system to coordinate those two systems so we can more easily track the prescribers and pharmacists that are going to use the system and more easily renew their privileges to use the system. Also, the vendors are going to help us to automate the process of verifying with the other licensing boards that the individuals who are applying to use the system are in fact licensed prescribers.
And Senator so, Madam Chair, I just so you would know, we have in the first 90 days of the program being set up, we have one person that visited 25 pharmacies for controlled substances. We have another individual that has 58 different prescriptions. They were all being filled within a 6-mile radius of each other. So this is pretty disturbing. It is the reason we set it up, so I'm glad to know that it's working to track these things. We also have had in 2007 reports of almost 10% of 12th graders reporting non-medical use of OxyContin and Vicodin. And so, you know, this is something that we believe that this registry will be able to help curtail, and I think it's important that we fund it.
Senator Berglund, on the A7, page 7.1 to 7.9, where it talks about the veterinary practice, is the objective there to determine that the Board of Pharmacy is going to determine whether or not that group of practitioners should be included in this registry? Is that what I'm understanding?
Right.
Senator Berglund?
Okay. Right. Whether they would be feeling a need to use the registry, and if so, then whether they should be helping to contribute to the cost of running it.
Mr. Weiberg.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I might elaborate on that. When the legislation was originally passed that created the prescription monitoring program, the veterinarians asked to be excluded from the program, and I talked with Dr. John King, who's the executive director of the Veterinary Medical Practice Board, and Dr. King convinced me that Fluffy doesn't doctor shop. Well, since then, in our conversations with other states that have these programs, we have had some information that suggests that, unfortunately, Fluffy's owner might use Fluffy to doctor shop. And so they might actually bring their pet in and fake symptoms and give false histories in order to get controlled substances that they would themselves subsequently use. And so there's a little bit of debate as to whether how extensive that problem is and whether they should be required to report the drugs that they dispense. They can actually use the system if they want. They can access the data in the system, but what they're not required to do is report what they dispense out of their veterinary practice offices, and veterinarians actually dispense a lot of drugs directly from their office.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Berglund or Dr. Weiberg. I'm curious about the inclusion of optometry as a funder. The Board of Optometry, I thought at first maybe you meant osteopathy, but it's probably included under medical practices.
Mr. Weinberg.
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solon, optometrists have limited prescribing authority, and they can prescribe some Schedule 4 controlled substances, although it's my understanding that they very rarely do so, but they can.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair,
Senator Prettner-Solon,
I think one of the issues here is any place you leave sort of a window open, the people that are doing this tend to gravitate there. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the reason.
Yeah. Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Berglund, I'm just, this is kind of a related but not specific question, but just kind of related to this program because I think it's really important. But I'm trying to remember how specific the information is that's available since we've started collecting this information. For example, could we look to see if there are particular geographic areas in the state where this is more of a problem than in others? I know that we can't get individual identifying information, but.
Mr. Weiberg.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we actually collect a large amount of information. We do get individual and identifying information actually on the patient and on the prescriber and on the pharmacy. We do actually get that.
But Madam Chair,
Senator Olson,
I don't think though I meant we can access that information as, say, state senators or members of the public. And so that's what I'm wondering about is how much of that information can we see to be able to see, you know, kind of if there are pockets of areas in the state where this is a problem.
Okay. Mr. Weiberg.
Madam Chair, Senator. Basically, the general public's not going to be able to access the database at all. It's secure. We will be generating reports from time to time. We certainly have a requirement in the legislation to report back to the legislature, and we can, because we do collect the information on both the patients and the providers, we can, in fact, determine if there are geographic pockets of the state where this is more of a prevalent problem. And that's certainly going to be reporting back to the legislature on that. And we can also put those sort of general reports that don't include anything that could identify individuals onto our website, which we'll do.
Any further discussion? Senator Berglund.
I'd like to move then that Senate file 3201 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Senator Sharon.
Just to that motion, I was reading through that you're assessing, it's an apportioned share based on prescribers and dispensers. And the Board of Optometry, the Board of Pharmacy, all are in support of this? Have they been contacted and have they been engaged? Do they understand this bill is happening and that they will be apportioned?
Oh, yes, they understand. They like this better than the previous version.
Right. Senator Berglund renews her motion that Senate file 3201 be laid over for possible inclusion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And the motion is adopted.
Madam Chair, maybe we could take 2748 next. There are people here who want to testify on it.
Senate file 2748. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and members, this bill is a very small, almost technical correction to the family cap section of our MFIP law. And it would clarify that the family cap would not be imposed unless the pregnancy occurred while on assistance and resulted in a live birth. Today, if a person was on MFIP 10 years ago, and because of the downturn in the economy, maybe they need to go back on the program today. And if they had a child during that intervening 10 years, that child would be counted against their ability to collect on the grant. And that is really what this bill is designed to do. The second provision amends the hard-to-employ hardship extension by clarifying persons who are determined to have a condition that severely limits the person's ability to obtain or maintain suitable employment would be added to the hardship category under the MFIP law. The bill has a very, very, very small fiscal note, and so I was thinking that perhaps it would be a small thing we could do to help a few families out during these hard times.
We'd like to hear from Jessica Webster. Ms. Webster, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senator Berglund explained what these two changes do. They're both rather technical, and so I can just stand for questions. If you have questions, I don't need to provide testimony.
Questions from members? Senator Berglund.
Then I would move that Senate File 2748 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
And Senator Berglund's motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Senate File 2748 is laid over for possible inclusion. The last item on our agenda is Senate File 2336. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File, the motion by which Senate File 2336 was recommended to pass be now reconsidered.
Senator Berglund.
We have had this bill before us, but apparently the folks that have been working on it wanted an amendment. The amendment has has a small cost, so we pulled it back from the full finance committee, and at this time I'd like to reconsider the motion by which it was recommended to pass to the full finance committee. So we'll have the bill back before us.
Senator Berglund's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
We have Senate File 2336 before us. Senator Berglund.
Oh, now I need somebody to give me the amendment.
I believe it's an A2.
Yeah, I think I just don't have it in my folder.
The A2 is in our packets.
Thank
you. Senator Berglund.
So what this amendment does is to slightly change the reimbursement in this pilot project that helps prevent hospitalizations for and missed school days for asthma. It slightly changes the reimbursement rate that would be provided for the two visits per child. And it limits the first visit to the payment rate that would be commensurate with a first-time visit rate, and then it would allow a follow-up visit rate. And,
are there questions?
It has
Senator?
A small fiscal note of $20,000 in fiscal year 11 and $6,000 in fiscal year 12.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I'm not sure if I'm interpreting this right. Does this mean that they get two visits for the price of one, or they get paid the same for each visit? Or
no, they get paid.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Prettner-Solin, they would get paid for the two visits.
Okay.
Under the pilot project the way it is now, I don't believe they're getting paid for both visits.
Okay.
Senator Berglund.
So if there are, did we vote on the amendment?
No. We should adopt the A2 amendment. Senator Bergen moves the adoption of the A2 delete everything amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
This A2 amendment is adopted. Senator Bergen.
If there are no further questions, then I would move that Senate file 2336 is amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
And Senator Berglund's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The Senate file 2336 is laid over as amended. Members are, we will meet again on Thursday, April 15th at 8:30 a.m. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.